Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. I'm Max Schor, and I want to welcome you to tonight's meeting of InForum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s. The mission here is to inspire debate about civic issues. So tonight we'll be talking about capitalism 3.0, the social capitalism revolution. I think we all see it. It's why we're all here in the room. But more and more companies are seeing it in their own interest to do good, whether it's green offices, fair trade, organic products. What is this social capitalism revolution? You know, should we believe in it, or is it greenwashing? Tonight our panel will help shed light on whether this trend will create lasting change. We have a wonderful panel. Let me introduce our panel. Cheryl O'Loughlin is the CEO of Clif Bar. She has directed the company's groundbreaking initiatives in the area of environmental sustainability. And at the same time, she's helped make Clif Bar one of the nation's fastest growing private companies for three consecutive years. Cheryl. Paul Rice is the founder, president, and CEO of Transfair USA, the only third-party certifier of fair trade products in the United States. Since its launch, Transfair has developed partnerships with over 500 U.S. companies and generated over $75 million in additional income for small farmers around the world. Paul Rice. Christine Arena is the author of Cause for Success and The High Purpose Company. She has over a decade of experience leading consumer research, trend forecasting, and marketing initiatives for a range of startup and Fortune 1000 brands. Christine. And finally, Adam Werbach is the CEO of Act Now Productions, a media organization for social change. Before Act Now, Werbach served as the youngest president for the Sierra Club, elected at just 23 years old. He's currently working with Walmart as a sustainability strategist. So, Adam. So we're going to start by questioning the panel, and I think we'll dig in with Christine. If you could just tell us a little bit about what is social capitalism, what's going on here?
I think it's about wisely investing in solutions to unmet social and environmental needs and problems. And if you think about it that way in terms of investing versus just trying to, quote, appear as doing the right thing, then you can see how the connection between social and financial kind of works together. That's how I define it.
Mm-hmm. And Cheryl, how do you see social capitalism at Clif Bar?
Yeah, at Clif Bar, we have a definition of social capitalism, which is based on our what we call our five bottom lines. And these are the foundation of the company. They really are the reason that we are in business. And quickly, those five are sustaining our business, sustaining our brands, sustaining the planet, our community, and our people. Can I take a second to explain each one?
Sure.
Sustaining our business is about being profitable. We have to be profitable to survive and thrive and be around for a long, long time. Sustaining our brands is we make delicious, nourishing, sustainable food for people on the go, like Clif Bars, our organic energy bar, Luna Bars, our whole nutrition bar for women. And our brands tell our story about our food, who we are, and what we value. So we treat our brands with tender, loving care. In terms of sustaining our planet, we're out to reduce our footprint on the planet. That is a bottom line for us. In terms of sustaining our community, we give back every year about 1% of our net sales in terms of our employee time, our food, and money. Again, a reason why we're in business. And finally, sustaining our people. We want to be a great place to work that inspires people and is inspired by people. So we do things like we have haircuts at work, massages, personal trainers, life coaches, that kind of fun stuff.
So that's a business that I think a lot of people would want to work for, and it's a really,
really
amazing business model, and I think a new one. And what's so exciting is, you know, it started out as a small business, but it's growing really fast. Paul Rice got his start because not all companies start with such a noble purpose. And maybe, Paul, you can talk about how you got started doing fair trade and how you learned about the power of the market to lift people up.
So you're not going to tell that whole revolution story, huh? I come at this issue perhaps from an unusual place, namely the mountains of northern Nicaragua, where I spent 11 years working with farmers. And my experience there was working on poverty alleviation through a number of different internationally funded projects. And, you know, they can be characterized as typical of, you know, kind of the dominant model that we have for addressing poverty and sustainability in the developing world, right? So very well-intentioned, bright people in Washington or London or Paris developing all kinds of projects and sending millions of dollars to the global south to solve problems and alleviate poverty. And my experience after 7 years of working in those kinds of projects is that the model is broken. It doesn't work. It recreates dependency on aid, and it doesn't really equip local communities, more often than not invariably, of course, but more often than not, that model doesn't equip people in local communities with the skills and abilities to solve their own problems. And so toward the end of my time in Nicaragua, I had a chance to kind of move in a different direction. I started a coffee export cooperative and led that for 4 years. And we kind of discovered that there was this thing called fair trade in Europe at the time, and buyers were paying us $1.26 a pound for coffee at a time in Europe, at a time when the local buyers were paying 10 cents a pound. So we were able to dramatically increase the income of our farmers, which in turn allowed them to put food on the table and keep their kids in school and bring electricity into the community and go organic and do all of these things that improve their quality of life and help sustain the ecosystem. And guess what? None of it depended on aid. None of it depended on someone else's charity. So that was transformational for me and took me from being pretty much anti-market and anti-business to seeing that actually there were huge opportunities in the global market for liberating the poor, for empowering the poor, and furthermore that you could actually ally with companies in that quest. And that kind of led me to where I am now.
I think that's fascinating. So Paul was sharing with me earlier the revolutionary thing, that he went down to Nicaragua because he was interested in this notion of a revolution, and historically that would take place outside of the capitalist system, and he found that rather than aid or organizing, engaging the market would really be the thing that could help these people the most. And in a similar sort of transition, Adam, you know, was really had a lot of notoriety as an organizer and an activist in the community, doing a lot of environmental work. And recently, he's engaged Walmart, a company with not always the best reputation. And now, having you know served at the top of Sierra Club and also sort of peered inside of Walmart, we're kind of curious to know, do you think the Sierra Club or Walmart could have a bigger impact on the environment? And what does that mean for this?
Wow. Could the Sierra Club or Walmart have a bigger effect on the environment? I think you need both. I think you need both. I think today today it's quite clear to me that if you want to solve the challenges that we know facing the environment today, when we talk about climate change, and you understand that climate change is a big problem, it's not a small problem, it's not a problem like that seemed big to us before, like ozone depletion, where you know a couple companies, if we could change them, we could change it. It's a problem that requires the whole change of the entire economy. In the context of problems that large, we need to work with institutions that are used to working at that scale. And, you know, frankly, when I was the president of the Sierra Club, it seemed huge. I mean, it just seemed enormous. The annual budget of the Sierra Club is roughly $75 million a year. I mean, a Sierra Club employs almost 500 people. One Walmart store does about $100 million in business. One Walmart store has about 500 employees. One Walmart store is the size of the Sierra Club. So when you realize that they have, of course, about 3,500 stores, in the U.S. alone, they have 1.3 million associates, employees, which in the U.S., about 1.8 million in the world. that basically something like one in every 100 working people in America work for Walmart, you begin to see an institution that is working at the scale of the problem that we're facing. The follow-up question, of course, is that now, is it capable, prepared, or does it even desire to tackle that?
I think most of you have heard about the recent commitments Walmart has made and that Adam's helping to implement and sort of strategize with. But recently, Walmart, what are some of Walmart's commitments that they've made as a company?
Well, Walmart, and really it's been led by Lee Scott, who's the CEO, I'm sure you've all seen this. It's an odd, I mean, it's nice having a CEO of a company here, but generally there's a executive vice or a vice president for sustainability who manages this. And at Walmart, and Paul, you know, I know you've interacted with Lee, it really is his initiative. And as much as anything else, it's his and Rob Walton's initiative. Mm-hmm. And when you have one shareholder who has 38% of your stock, it makes it a little easier. Walmart has committed to three things. First, to be powered 100% by renewable energy. And it's no small feat since they're the largest private consumer of energy in America. They buy about $1 billion of energy a year. Two, to produce zero waste. And three, to basically only sell green products. That's their commitment. Now, the follow-up question is, okay, by when, right? Because it's like, yeah, anyone can say it. The truth is that they don't know. And they don't know because we don't know. Those of us who are exposed to be experts in those things can't tell anyone of that scale how to make that sort of change. Mm-hmm. I mean, Walmart, for example, you know, deodorant used to be in boxes. You know, deodorant mm-hmm. used to be in little boxes. And Walmart, this was actually before their environmental initiative, this large environmental initiative, just figured out that the boxes didn't add any value to the product, cost them money to ship. So they asked their manufacturers to stop using boxes. Well, now deodorant isn't in boxes. Mm-hmm. They're used to making changes at this scale in a way that we are not. So in truth, the only thing we can rate right now is their progress towards those goals. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to actually give a timeline.
It's a fascinating reality and eager to see how that plays out. Christine has talked a lot in her books about why businesses are doing this and what's a successful sort of win-win strategy for doing something good and making money and what's a failed strategy. Maybe you can help shed some light on why Walmart is doing this. Why would a company make those commitments? And is it enough to just say that, or what do they actually need to do to make it work for them?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that a man like Lee Scott and a company like Walmart, which is one of the most powerful companies in the world, is not going to invest heavily in green, become overnight one of the largest purveyors of organic products in the world, green its supply chain, thereby influencing almost the development of foreign nations because, say, in China, I think it's something like a sixth of China's exports are sourced through Walmart. You know, so a company like that is not going to make a decision to go green because it's moral or trendy. Okay, they're going to do it because they think it's the right thing for their shareholders. That is probably a company that more than any other company I've ever engaged with has such meticulous data on, they can tell that in their green stores, for instance, on the side of the green stores that are sunlit, they move 30% more product. And they have lower rates of employee absenteeism. They've literally, everything is a science at Walmart. So I think that that's a really fascinating case, and it's a good example of social capitalism. That is not to say that Walmart is a perfect company. It is to say that it is hugely powerful. So when a company like Walmart throws its hat in the ring and actually invests heavily, I think it's something like $300 million in renewables to make their, or in energy efficiency efforts to make their truck fleet, which is the biggest truck fleet in the nation, more efficient. That has huge, huge environmental, social, and financial implications. So I think that's pretty significant.
So they're doing it in part for their own self-interest. They think this is a long-term strategic interest. If they don't do this, they're going to be in a lot of trouble.
I think it's a matter of being proactive versus mm-hmm. reactive. A good friend of mine in the audience is Gil Friend, and he is famous for saying, and I love when he says this, that the companies that wait around for regulations before they evolve to advance strategies are going to be playing catch-up forever. So this is a matter of being proactive versus reactive and actually leading the market trend versus following.
And so I think a lot of people in the audience here are responsible for that by making the consumer choices that they do. And Paul knows a lot about that. But first I want to go to Cheryl. She, with Clif Bar, has a very interesting story because they decided to go organic a long time before it was fashionable, and it wasn't at all clear that it was going to be in their own business interest. How did you decide to go organic with Clif Bar, and was it something your customers demanded, or how was that decision made?
Well, in the year 2000, Gary Erickson, our founder, had the opportunity to sell the company. All of our competitors were getting bought out by the largest food companies in the world, and his hand was this close to signing away that company. Walked away from $60 million. And he didn't know at the time, he really couldn't articulate why he made that decision. He just knew it was right in his gut. And it was probably about a year later where he finally said to me, you know, I think I can express why I did this. And it's because I didn't want to lose the soul of my company. And what my company is about helping to create a better world. And once he articulated that and he articulated our five bottom lines, we put a stake in the ground and said, these are the reasons why we are in business. We measure ourselves against those five bottom lines. Our employees are getting bonus based on all five. And one of those, of course, was sustaining the planet. And it was in the year 2003. We had always had natural food, but we had no organic ingredients. And so we said, okay, this is the right thing to do. We're going to do it. And we actually went out and we did some focus groups. And we asked consumers, so what do you think? If we go organic, would you be excited? And their answer, believe it or not, was, no, it wouldn't matter to us. So we said, okay, now what do we do? Our consumers don't seem to really want it, but it's what we believe in. So we started moving towards organic. By the end of that year, 2003, Clif Bar, the bar, was 70% organic. And now we're at 80% organic ingredients, so buying about 20 million pounds of organic ingredients every year. And it's great because now consumers want it too, so we're all in line.
So it's a really interesting example because if they hadn't had these values and this purpose, you know, companies like Walmart might never have found out that it's in their business interest to do this. So it's very sort of a different dynamic. And I think, you know, that is something Paul must be dealing with a lot is, you know, in being the certifier for fair trade coffee and other fair trade products. Is there a consumer demand for that? Are consumers willing to spend more money? And what is the importance of metrics and credibility as consumers make their decision in this new landscape?
Yeah, I think if there's a revolution going on, it's a revolution among consumers as much as, if not more than in the business community. I mean, clearly there are some companies that believe in sustainability and it's part of their DNA and they see themselves as in the business of contributing to changing the world. I think those businesses, unfortunately, are in the minority. So I think a lot of businesses are kind of following the trends or trying to predict the trends and react to what is clearly now a groundswell of consumer awareness and concern about social environmental issues. And furthermore, a growing awareness that the point of purchase is a legitimate place for us to express our values. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, the stuff that we buy has an impact on the world. And, you know, the anesthesia that we've all been breathing as a society for so many years is starting to dissipate, and people are starting to realize, holy shit, you know, with this cup of coffee, I can, you know, help save the world, and with this other one, I can make sure that kids don't go to school, you know, and have to go to the fields every day. I mean, that's a stark way of putting it. And, you know, actually, there are probably relatively few people that realize that those two cups of coffee represent dramatically different outcomes for ecosystems and families. But a growing number do.
Is there a price point for how much the average American consumer is willing to pay extra for fair trade coffee?
I think the data is pretty clear across the board, whether it's organics, fair trade, any kind of labeled product, or sustainably positioned product, that consumers are willing to pay more. It's an attribute. It's, I mean, Look at advertising on TV. We're sold emotional attributes every time we see an ad for cosmetics or clothes or cars or any number of products. So this is nothing new. When we acquire organic or sustainable products or fair trade products, we're not only getting the product attributes of the coffee itself, but then the feelings associated with that, depending on what it is. And so the answer is consumers are willing to pay to feel good about the things that they buy. Now, there's a curve there, so they're not willing to pay an indefinite amount. Most fair trade products end up hitting the shelves at between 5% and 10% more than a comparable quality product. So, if you're already paying $10 a pound for gourmet coffee, to pay $10.50 or $11 a pound for that to be organic or fair trade proves not to be a huge barrier. And that's the good news, because it suggests that people understand at some basic level that the notion of externalities that economists talk about, the notion that the cost to society and the planet of bad business, is actually, that's not for someone else. I think a growing number of people realize you either pay now or you pay later. So why not pay a little bit now rather than pay a lot later? Now, we're talking about a certain segment here, what we call the conscience consumer. And I think what's bold about what Walmart is doing, what's bold about 650 McDonald's bringing fair trade organic coffee into McDonald's stores in New England last year, what's bold about Dunkin' Donuts launching a whole new line of espresso coffee and having it being 100% fair trade, is that they're clearly going beyond what we would all assume to be the conscious consumer segment, that 20, 30, 40 million people in America who are relatively better educated, more enlightened, and willing to put their money where their mouth is around sustainability. So the cool thing is that McDonald's rolls fair trade coffee last year and sales jumped by 45%. The cool thing is that Sam's Club, which is owned by Walmart, rolls fair trade and organic coffees, sales go through the roof. The cool thing is that Dunkin' rolls its fair trade espresso line and sales go through the roof. So it's starting to challenge our notions of who is actually the consumer of these sustainable products, right? Who's the consumer of fairness and sustainability? And is it really just a tiny sliver of crunchy granola Birkenstock folks? Or, is there something that resonates with the core values of America around, fairness for the poor, or, a planet that we can actually leave in decent shape for our grandkids? So, I mean, that's the optimist in me speaking, and I think what we all have to do is go out and awaken that sleeping giant and get her to go buy the stuff.
That's very interesting, because I know Cheryl was saying that when they started to go organic, there wasn't a demand. And when I buy a Clif Bar, I didn't even realize it was organic. I just, the actual bar is the best tasting one for me. The packaging is beautiful, and it works, and I feel a little better. And I'm not being paid to say that, but I mean, I think it's crucial. You can have fair trade, you can have organic, but the product actually has to compete, in terms of price, in terms of quality. How important is that for you guys?
At our core, we believe that we are contributing great food to the world. Delicious food, nourishing food, and sustainable food. And we talk so much at our company about how food matters. We're not going to draw people to us if our food's not great. Most people know us because of our bars. And they enjoy our bars, and they might not know the rest of the story. But once they get connected and they become part of our community, we start having a dialogue, and not only do they learn from us, but we learn from them, and we get better all the time because of that dialogue. So hopefully our great fruit is going to draw everyone in so we have a really great community to talk about all this stuff.
Absolutely. And I was interested because with Paul saying, I think the consumers definitely play a huge role, as we hear. But for Adam, in terms of Walmart's new initiatives, is it something that's consumer-driven? Is it CEO-driven? And who are the Walmart consumers versus the consumers Paul's talking about? Is it the same thing?
Well, I guess we can do a little. I mean, before walking into this room, how many of you had heard of fair trade?
Wow.
Okay, so every hand is raised. Would you pay more for a product that has environmental or sustainable qualities? Raise your hand if you would. Okay, I'd say almost all the hands, 90%. Raise your hand if you've been in a Walmart in the last year. Okay, so there's about, I'd say, 10, 15% of people who have. 89% of Americans walk into a Walmart every year. Roughly 150 million people a week. So that is it's the best example of a mass American market, a mass of what American shoppers are. It includes the conscious shoppers, largely, unless there's just 11% of them. But it includes sort of all of America in a way that's strange to those of us who live in San Francisco, where there isn't a Walmart, or people who are in New York or in coastal cities, or deep in cities, mostly. You know, my experience when I walk into a Walmart is, like, for example, if you sit by the check register and you just watch as people come out, and they're really, I mean, the checkers are really fast. They get people in and out real quick. And in every hour, there are about 6 or 7, maybe 8 people who come through the check stand who have too many things in their cart compared to how much money they have. So they have takeouts. They have this experience, and we probably may have experienced this. It's kind of embarrassing, you know. What am I going to take out? And at that moment, if you watch what they take out, my experience is that what you watch them take out are the things that we would consider, I might consider, good and healthy. So the fresh fruits and vegetables come out, the vitamin supplements come out, exercise equipment comes out. And what stays in are the double-stuffed Oreos. What stays in are the magazines and the DVDs and the video games. And I, you know, one of the things that I guess the question I would ask is it a question for us of the organic carrot versus the non-organic carrot, or is it the question of the carrot versus the Oreo? And do we first have to get people to eat carrots and understand that carrots are great and make you feel better, much better than an Oreo will? That, you know, it's nice to have Oreos, though. I'm not against Oreos. But can you do that? And the answer isn't, of course, the organic Oreo. That's not a small point. And I think it's an area of major risk for us. It's not that I think organic standards, per se, will be lowered, because it could actually be an Oreo made by, you know, with all the right things, done all the right ways, certified. But is that really what we mean by organic? Is that what it stands for? And I think that's a great movement towards the word sustainable as opposed to organic, because it's a higher standard that actually asks the question, does it actually serve my whole body? Does it serve my what I want as a lifestyle? And is that what we're trying to pitch out? Or are we going to be in more of an environmental framework, which is largely about don't do the wrong thing, you know, stop bad pesticides, as opposed to live a healthy life?
Mm-hmm. What's amazing is about this, and just hearing you talk about Walmart in general, and thinking of framing Walmart as a company that's trying to have all renewable energy, lead the way with organics, all of this is, they've shifted from a company that, you know, screwed their workers to a company that's, you know, pushing forward on solutions. And is this something that we should trust, Christine? Is this greenwashing, or are they for real? And how do we know if we should take this serious?
Well, I think we, in general, need to be very cognizant of the difference between greenwashing and green growth and bandwagons and behavioral changes. And the easy way to figure that out is just by following the money trail. Okay, so if my research has always showed me that true corporate responsibility is not a form of philanthropy or marketing. It's also not necessarily about this idea of companies doing good, because what happens in corporations is that the translation of doing good is translated into philanthropy, a form of philanthropy, a peripheral side interest, not mission critical to a company. But when corporate responsibility is seen as an integral business strategy, as just a matter of taking responsibility for things, for the way a company behaves currently, in the future, and in the past, and being proactive, again, investing, wisely investing in solutions to unmet needs and problems ranging from poverty to climate change to water scarcity, and also issues or externalities, like you were saying, that a business creates, then it becomes a a means of green growth, good growth. So you can really tell the difference between a company that's greenwashing and a company that's legitimately invested in green growth by asking a very simple litmus test question. The question I always ask, and the question I ask in my book is purpose invaluable to the company? And what I mean by that is that there are so many companies out there that claim to stand for some grandiose purpose that serves the common good, some social or environmental cause. But fewer of those companies actually absorb and reflect that purpose to the point where their own business depends upon it. Where if you remove that purpose, the company would be much worse off. It would have difficulty competing, and society and the world would be worse off without the company, therefore. So I really think asking, just cutting right to the chase and forgetting this idea of labeling companies as good or bad, but looking at which ones are producing the most value, which ones are making the biggest difference, which ones are producing the most social, environmental, and economic impact, that is really, I think, where we need to go in this conversation to be more constructive about it. I think it's where the socially responsible investment industry needs to go, because along with consumers, investors clearly make a difference with their dollars, and I think it's where the CSR industry standards should move, and hopefully that's what we'll see play out in the next, you know, 5 or so years.
Definitely. I'd like to hear all of you guys just try to briefly answer a question of whether you think this is altruism or if it's in your self-interest. Like, when you go to work, is this something that you want to do, or is this something you're doing for the sake of others? And I think, yeah, so let's just try to briefly answer that if it's possible.
This is my job, what I do at Clif Bar. This is my vocation. This is what somehow I was meant to do in life. And what's so cool at Clif Bar is that I think all our people believe that with their heart and soul, that they're out to make a difference. Is that altruism? Is an I don't know. Hopefully it's just lending good to the world. But the fact that we're doing work and every day we're absorbed in what we love and what we think is making a difference, to me, that's what matters.
So my organization is positioned a little differently because we're a nonprofit organization and we provide an audit and certification service to the industry. When they buy direct from farmers and pay a fair trade price, they can use our label on the package. And we've now formed alliances with over 600 companies here in the United States in coffee, tea, chocolate, bananas, rice, sugar, a whole bunch of products. So we have interacted with lots of visionary, values-driven people like Cheryl. Unfortunately, they're the minority of the business community, at least the business community that we have engaged with. I think most companies are led by people who, you know, at the end of the day have to deliver numbers. And so the financial bottom line is really, primary, but they would like to be able to do it in a way that also delivers value to the planet. And so, what we're finding is companies really looking for the business case for fair trade and for more sustainable practices. And in the case of coffee, it was easy for them to find it because over the last, from 2000 to 2005, world coffee prices slumped to their lowest level in the history of coffee, which meant that farmers were starving, which meant they weren't investing in quality, right? I mean, it was like, do I produce quality or do I feed my kids? So faced with that dichotomy, coffee quality in the industry went down, and what the industry here, at a time when gourmet coffee was booming and consumers were asking for better quality, what the industry was finding is you get what you pay for. If you pay low market prices, you get lousy coffee and consumers are unhappy. So there was a real alignment of fair trade with the imperative for companies to get high quality product, right? Companies needed to pay a higher price to farmers than market price in order to ensure a stable, high quality supply chain. So there was an alignment of interests which we helped wed and fuse. And, you know, there are other reasons why people come to these models, whether it's fair trade or other sustainability initiatives. Reputational gain Reputational benefit is clearly something that drives companies into this arena, and you know, the search for profitability. And I think that's the interesting territory. So I don't think it's like altruism versus selfishness. And if a company is not into sustainability out of the goodness of their hearts, then they're somehow unworthy, and we should go out and kick their ass, right? Like, you know, I really think that at the end of the day,
okay.
Sorry, Stan. I made Stan a promise today that I would cuss less. You know, I really think the interesting thing is to find business models that don't force companies to sacrifice profitability in order to do the right thing. Like, wouldn't it be cool if we could invent a new version of capitalism in which doing the right thing was actually more profitable, right? In which saving the planet and making sure that workers and farmers got a decent living wage, that actually helped the company made more money, right? Or at least as much. So that's the quest that we're on, right? And I think at the end of the day, it does depend on consumer awareness. I mean, there's no other way to sustain that. And so, you know, I think we're in a moment of experimentation.
Thank you. That's very interesting. And Christine, I think that vision you just played out is very exciting. And Christine was talking earlier about a couple of examples that are living that reality. Perhaps you could talk about a couple success stories, maybe GE and DuPont or
sure,
whoever.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, I think it's an illusion that we need to choose between being purpose-driven or altruistic and financially profitable. I hate when people say that because it's not true. I think that that's a ridiculous thing, and it's not true. And if you look at companies like GE, GE invests $1.8 billion annually in environmental technologies. From that investment, it has a huge array of products, ranging from water scarcity solutions to energy-efficient dishwashers to hybrid locomotives. Those products generate $10 billion annually for GE shareholders. By 2010, they will generate $20 billion. That's 15% annual or organic growth. At DuPont, by next year, 25% of the company's revenues will come from sustainable solutions that are, this is DuPont's language, essential to a better, safer, healthier life for people everywhere. So that means innovative breakthroughs like BioPDO, which is a polymer that is made from corn that uses less energy to make and also produces less waste, translates brilliantly into fabrics or carpet. A huge range of products there. So if you look at companies, and even Toyota, a company that is dedicated to the purpose of making sustainable mobility a reality. I was talking about proactive versus reactive strategies before. And if you look at the auto industry, it's a neat example because now you have a case before the Supreme Court where Detroit automakers are up in arms about this. They do not want EPA standards to increase, and they don't want the federal government through the EPA to increase environmental standards that would insist that they reduce emissions by a certain date. That's reactive, right? That's defensive. That's short term. That's that old mindset that says we have to trade off between doing good and doing well, which is bogus. Then you look at the companies that are taking market share. Toyota, Honda. Why are they taking market share? Because they excel. They exceed both customer and industry and environmental expectations. They exceed standards. They go beyond. And they are innovative in every way. So that leads me to believe that, okay, in the best cases where corporate responsibility works the best, it's not really even corporate responsibility anymore the way we narrowly define it. These companies are actually innovating in a totally new way. And that again cuts to the heart of what social capitalism is all about and why it can make such a big difference.
You know, for our company, Act Now, you know, I stood here about almost 2 years ago now and gave a talk saying that I believe that environmentalism is dead. And now we work with Walmart and other huge companies. So everyone who comes to work for Act Now has to walk through fire to some extent to get in the door. And that helps. So we have a strong culture of believing that you should tell people when they have food in their teeth. And that allows us to attract people who, I mean, they're working right now trying to figure out this challenge, right? How do you actually make this stuff matter to the broadest scope of the American public? And we understand that it doesn't yet. And it will. It will. It's right to, it's on the cusp, but we need people now to grab an oar, to get in, and to start, you know, getting in this game. It is happening right now. We have this moment. The window is open for some reason, right? I mean, the Democrats have Congress, so that means that corporations are saying, wow, the stuff is coming down the hill. Walmart is changing. I mean, like, this is like, you know, next pigs flying. So it's the moment now to, you know, to get into it and to really commit. I have to say that it's fun, you know. That's the fun part, at least. And I probably share this with everyone here. It's that we don't know what the hell we're doing, and we're all supposed to be the experts. I mean, the experts don't know anything. And that's the invention moment that we're in. And the nice thing about being, frankly, in the Bay Area is that this is where those conversations are happening the fastest. We're the farthest ahead. This is where companies come to ask the questions. So we have this sort of wonderful moment to join.
Mm-hmm. In about 5 minutes, we're going to open it up for questions. So if people want to line up at the mic, we can or start thinking about your question. We'll be taking questions in about 5 minutes. So I guess we're hearing a lot of the positive side of things and the possibility and that you can be profitable and, you know, add value for society. What is something that you think could be an obstacle to this movement, you know, or stop it? Or do you think that this is inevitable, that this is a winning movement and that nothing can stop this?
I brought a sight gag, which I guess this is on radio, so it doesn't help. But I was just in Kansas City, which is the Walmart has a big supplier summit, and something like one-third of the global economy is represented in this one room. And one of the things that I was given was SR-126, which is the new Diet Coke, Diet Coke Plus, Diet Coke with benefits. This is Diet Coke with vitamins and minerals in it. And I'm a Diet Coke fan, so I was kind of first excited. And then I got really sad and scared. And I think the big risk right now is that people know that we're looking for healthier options. They know that the public is leading edge and moving towards this. Has anyone seen a 7-Up campaign that says, now all natural? And there's like a hummingbird flying by and eating this. There's nothing natural about 7-Up. I mean, like, come on. It's not natural. That's not natural. The biggest risk is that this is going to get taken. Like, that while we're here moving, and while we have to move faster and better and our game has to improve, is that they're coming. They're coming with SR-126. They're coming with all-natural 7-Up. Mm-hmm. And we have to come back with what we mean is sustainable, right, by keeping and raising the bar. And frankly, I mean, Walmart's got to go a lot better than those three goals. You know, they've got a lot further, and they've still got a huge number of problems they have to address. And I don't want to let any of that cover that up. We're not letting them off the hook. You can't, mm-hmm. if you just because you recycle doesn't mean you don't have responsibility to your employees.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think for us, for Clif Bar, we made a choice to stay private, and that was because we could that way control our destiny and make the choices that we thought were right based on what we valued. And I think one of the really challenging parts is the fact that the market is the way it is, and stockholders have the demands that they have for their own good reasons, but is there a way that one day we could create a way to truly reward companies that are making a difference in all of these areas, not just money? I mean, how much money do we really need? What if making a difference in the environment and making the difference to people is just as important as how much money we make? And a way to really change that is to really change the way we reward companies. And consumers can help, that's for sure.
Well, two concerns. One's kind of dorky, but, you know, we're talking about, you know, double bottom lines and triple bottom lines and you know, companies that are pursuing not only financial gain, but also social and environmental gain. And yet, we don't really have the tools yet to quantify social and environmental gain. And until we develop better tools, I think we, you know, those of us who want to see the world change and those who want to see companies do better, we're always going to be at a disadvantage because it's just a little bit too fuzzy right now. We need, you know, dollars are very easy to quantify. So the financial bottom line is eminently quantifiable. We need to figure out the metrics and the tools for quantifying the rest of it. And then I think we can measure companies' performance more easily and demand better performance. The other piece that keeps me up at night is kind of along the same lines as what Adam was just saying, which is that I think as it becomes apparent that there's money to be made in the sustainability business, that people are going to companies that are going to come on board and try and cut corners, scam the system, seek lower bars than the highest standards around, and try and sell that as natural 7-Up. So I do think that is going to be a reaction from companies who aren't really bought in and who aren't really interested in exploring the business case for sustainability. They just don't want to get left behind, but they don't want to spend too much money in the process. And again, I think you're right. That really makes it incumbent on all of us to discern the different bars that are out there and support those that really do make a difference. Mm-hmm.
Your time is up, and I'm just going to give Christine a one sentence to say.
Use it well.
The metrics exist, first of all, definitely. This is a run-on sentence. The metrics exist. It is possible to quantify the environmental impact companies make, and it is also definitely possible to quantify the environmental benefits generated by the things that companies sell and the way they do business. It is also possible to quantify socially how many people are affected by a company's way of doing business. And I think that the industry as a whole is getting a lot better at that. And that is going to be the key. That is going to be the key to making this all work, is going, look, here's the proof. Here's what we're doing. Here's the value. And then just really quickly, I'm sorry, I can never answer a question in one sentence. I'm terribly sorry. I think the one barrier that every company faces at this point is collaboration. Because you can have these brilliant visions, these brilliant ambitions to go green. You can take the metrics and make them into goals. You can follow, you can put a company's strengths toward that. But unless everyone within the company begins working together, unless this corporate responsibility thing moves from a department and infiltrates every area of a company's business, progress stalls. So I think that is a key thing.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program. And tonight, we're talking about capitalism 3.0 and the social capitalism revolution. I'm Mac Shore of Good, and I'm here with Cheryl O'Loughlin, CEO of Clif Bar, Paul Rice, President and CEO of Transfair USA, Christine Arena, corporate strategist and author, and Adam Werbach, sustainability strategist for Walmart. So at this point, we'll go to the audience and take about 20 minutes of questions. So I'll start with you.
Good evening. Thank you very much for coming out this evening, especially as a former environmental sustainability marketing manager for DuPont. I appreciate the good words because we were very proud of what we were doing at DuPont and the difference we were making. So thank you very much for speaking nicely about us. My question, I guess, is really for Christina and Cheryl, especially as business people. One of the things I found was that it's fairly easy to convince CXO-level officials of the need to be environmentally responsible and sustainability. Smart from a sustainability standpoint, because they have the power of the purse in the corporation. But then when you get down into the lower levels of the company, it was a lot harder to build those connections because of the incentives. So I was wondering, both of you mentioned that incentives played a role in the companies you've worked with in driving responsible behaviors at lower levels. So I was wondering if you could talk about that more.
Sure. Well, at Clif Bar, every Thursday we get together and we had kind of our community meeting and we talk a lot about our bottom lines and our aspirations. It's the core of everything. And we've been talking about them since 2000. And once people really started to understand and work with them and make decisions based on them, because they needed to start to practice it themselves and they needed the I guess, space to be able to do that and to be able to be told, wow, you made a choice that helped the environment, but it might have cost the company, at least in the short term, a little more, and that's good and that's okay, and try it again. And once we started doing that and people started getting the hang of it, and just this year we went to everyone and we said, okay, guys, it's time. We've got to start creating a bonus system that's based on us taking accountability for every single one of these bottom lines. And we did that, and we were really afraid by the end of the year to say, okay, guys, this is your bonus, and it's based on all five, and what would they say, and would they understand? And they got it. It was almost as if it was always that way. It was, should be that way. And so I think that's what's so important about having it embedded in the core of what you do, is people just say, of course, this is the way it is.
Yeah, I would agree with Cheryl, because it is an idea about shared responsibility and not making this the the mandate of a few people in one little area of the company, but making this part of everything from the way an employee gets evaluated, but to other incentives as well. But here's the thing. It's really important to focus on this idea of innovation and how innovation works. And that's really what corporate responsibility is today. It's about innovation and change, not charity. So what that means is companies have got to set up the optimal internal structure to enable that to occur. And that means breaking down old barriers. That means getting the product development people and the marketing people and the environmental department and the CFO in a room together to figure out, you know, how, change can come from anywhere. And at McDonald's, change, it was not a top-down thing. Actually, most often in the cases I've evaluated, purpose trickles up from below. It comes from someone in a manager somewhere who has a great idea, and he brings that to the attention of senior management, or a small initiative within a company like Nike that is does so well that overall it starts to influence the company's policy, and over time that starts to influence the nature of the company's products. So I really think that people need, and companies really need to start to set up that internal structure that enables creativity.
Great.
Hi. Hello. Hi, my understanding about the working conditions in Walmart stores is that they continue to get worse. And I'm really not that excited about adding solar panels to a sweatshop. But my question is for Christine. A number of companies are, you know, I buy my office products from a company that gives 3% of their sales back to the world.
Right.
And Clif Bar, great, 1%. Are there any companies that are going all the way to a 50-50 corporation? Anything more than 50% is a charity, but anything less seems a little disappointing. Are there any companies that are going to that high of percentage?
Not that I know of, especially not publicly traded companies, because that would be ludicrous. And let me explain why I think it would be ludicrous, and then I'd like to hear from you what you thought about what I just said. So the making money is not a rule. It's not the point of the game of business. It's just a rule. And more people are asking in the business world, well, what's the point? If you start to sell things and run in such a way that it actually creates tremendous benefits for society, if you start to get to the point where you become invaluable to people and worthy of succeeding, not just successful, but worthy of succeeding, you've crossed this brink. So I think that we need to go, it's not about writing a check to charity. It's not about saying, let's pilfer our revenues and give them to different causes, because that's not an economically sustainable model for corporations given our current capitalist system. Unless we come up with a new capitalist system, that demands different things, a different kind of a stock market, a different kind of expectations in the marketplace, I don't know that you will see really, really successful multinationals giving more than maximum 5% to charity, nor do I think they should, because I think they can make a bigger difference in the long run by going deep and working with environmental groups as through stakeholder engagement to help make a bigger difference, to try to run their businesses in a more conscious and intelligent way that meets the needs of stakeholders. So that would be my answer, but you could agree or disagree.
I think that's a very compelling answer. We'll move on to the next question. You guys can discuss afterwards as well.
I'd like to address the issue of consumption. And
each or a couple of you up there advocating particularly sustainable products, but we live in a planet with ecological limits, which we're currently exceeding, and consumption itself is part of the problem. So, you know, a lot of us have read natural capitalism and heard this idea of service versus and flow-based economies as opposed to just product economies. And I'd be curious to hear from anyone really about what your thoughts are on the potential to move away from American style of consume more and more and more, and that's how we'd get profit, versus more service and just less of a ecological footprint per product, for example, kind of economy. Do you want me to answer?
I hate to keep answering and hog the microphone, so please jump in, because I think Paul will have something to say about this, as will you. When President Bush, 4 years ago, I think, I said, and I'm going to paraphrase what he said, we should continue with the American way of life. I almost died. Because that is ridiculous. We cannot continue to consume. See, what Paul was saying is that this movement is consumer-driven. What that means, it's market-driven. What that means is that you drive it. We drive it. Companies don't. They respond to demand. And so we are part of the cycle. So the cycle won't change unless every single person does what they can to make a difference. Now, that does not mean that we should all live in yurts and, you know, wear hemp and not buy any products. But it means we need to think about what we do. And I think that we are reaching a point, as Paul Hawken eloquently states, where that's happening. It's almost like a tipping point, not just for businesses, but for consumer awareness around these issues and for this collective will, this uprising of people that are going to participate in the product, in the process of change versus kind of stand there and watch it happen. What do you think?
Does anybody else want to respond to that, or should we move to the next?
I think we can cycle through the questions. I want to get more people up. Talk.
How do you see corporate volunteerism fitting within this frame of social capitalism? And just to be a little bit more specific, what changes do you see in companies actually investing human capital in our global efforts?
You know, at Cliff Bar, what we found is part of our model is for people to give their time back to the community. And, you know, if you think about, I think it's five counties in the Bay Area, there's about 1 million employees. Just think, if each company said to each one of those employees, I'll just give you an hour on company time to go out and do volunteer work, it would be 1 million hours of service. It takes so little to make such a difference. So for us, that's a critical component to it. It's what our people do out in the world. They can then bring that back from what they've learned back to our company.
And one of the projects we've been working on at Walmart is the question was, could you get the associates, the people who work there, to care about this? Because if they could care about it, then maybe the customers would, because the customers and the associates look kind of like the same people. So we've started with about 130 stores. And in those 130 stores, the associates are given time, paid time on the clock, to at the store to start engaging in this, engaging each other in the conversation around sustainability. And what Walmart just committed to do is to roll that out to every one of their stores, where associates will be given paid time to start figuring out sustainability. I mean, really trying to figure out within the four walls of the store first and among their fellow associates how to make it matter there. And I think it's going to be one of the smartest investments that they've made in terms of time.
Great. Hopefully we'll have time for three more questions, but I'm afraid that's probably the most. But if you want to go.
Okay. I've been hearing a lot of talks of fashions and trends, and I wish those weren't as associated with this movement that we're experiencing now, because I don't think it does it much justice. But fashions and trends aside, I'm still going to pick on Walmart. So I come from Geneva, New York, which is a small town and small community like many others across the country that has a Walmart there. And what we're dealing with now is Walmart looking to expand. So here we are talking about these initiatives Walmart is taking, as many of these other companies are. But just recently, Walmart has passed the CEQA environmental impact qualifications and is looking to go on and expand as they would any other normal Walmart, the traditional Walmart we have now. So all this talk going on in this dialogue, which is great, and I am aware that this is the Bay Area, It's a bit more progressive than upstate New York. I'm aware of that. So why is nothing being done in the sense that if this is going to happen in a year's time, why are we still building this? There's still time to change it. I mean, why isn't Walmart really taking the initiative and education being the key? Why aren't we exposing this demographic of people in a part of the country that isn't as fortunate as we are here to be exposed to this? Why wouldn't they go through and just say, you know what, why can't we build this? Why can't we expand this Walmart green, especially considering, say, 30% of profits, a 30% profit increase on a green store? I guess that might not be a very specific question, but if you could touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I the question obviously asks a number of challenges around scale and change. I mean, Walmart has a few prototype stores that have great leaps ahead, wind-powered, solar, better air conditioning systems, better floors, all that. And those are rolling out. So there's, I think, something like 10 prototypes now that have gone from those three that started at McKinney and in Colorado. And they'll roll out very rapidly because it saves them money and it makes sense. I think one of the harder questions is, you know, and this is what we were talking earlier about publicly traded companies, the market demands growth. The market demands growth. It demands comp store sales. You know, can you actually increase what the same store sold the year before? And if you can't grow, even if you're profitable, it doesn't matter for the market, for share price. And that single factor drives the nightmares of so many corporate CEOs and boards. And I think it ends up boiling down all the way to upstate New York.
More second, I'm sorry.
We're going to have to move on to the next question, okay. But thank you. It's a good question.
Sure. I guess my question has to do with the phrase too little, too late. And Senator Feinstein gave a speech a few months ago about global warming, climate change. And afterwards, I asked her if there would be a time when the government would perceive that as a national security threat. And she said, well, if the scientists, what they predict is going to happen, happens, then definitely will become a national security threat. So along those lines, do we reach a tipping point where we realize that we're sort of like in World War II, but in a climate change sense, and that galvanizes the nation and the government and capitalism to do a rapid changeover?
Did anyone see Larry King last night? Feinstein was on. It was an interesting panel on global warming, and you had the skeptics and the advocates, and I still can't believe there are skeptics, but that's just my opinion. I think we have reached that tipping point. I think because a couple of yo-yos on Capitol Hill still believe that one out of 15,000 scientists have questions, so what? The critical mass of people in this nation believe it's real. I think on Friday when that report is issued, that will provide even more compelling evidence. And I think when you have, you know, I mean, I'm stating opinion here. So, I mean, you know, but I think that the public, it seems, and there are public consensus figures that show that the critical mass of people in this country are aware of it, understand that it's a problem, and feel we need to do something about it.
But the thing is that, and again, this is opinion as well, you know, there's so many people who live in the Bay Area, there's so many people outside of here that just don't see that we've actually caused this and that we can make a difference if we stop. I was talking to my brother one day, and I was horrified. He said to me, people don't cause climate change. It's like, how can you say this? You're my brother. But people believe this still, and we have to keep talking about it.
Okay, I have a question to kind of play devil's advocate a little bit. I read an article in December in The Economist, which many of you probably have seen, really questioning the whether global... It really helps to buy organic and vote with your trolley or your shopping cart, and if it really does improve the environment. And, you know, rather than regurgitating all the arguments in the article, I mean, one of them is that organics takes up more land space to grow, and one of them is that buying locally grown things is actually bad because there's greater fuel food miles, I guess, on getting the goods to the market, and then the consumers getting to the markets by them. So if you could respond to some of those criticisms of your movement, I think it would be really enlightening, because I think being in the Bay Area, we all tend to be rah-rah and on board with these ideas, but don't know what to say when someone challenges us.
Well, basically, if The Economist is attacking it, it's probably an indication that it's a good thing. Yeah, we saw the article, obviously, too, and it's a kind of a frontal attack on the economics of fair trade and organics and other sustainability approaches. And, you know, I think what isn't smart about the article is that it really ignores the market data, which shows that these products sell, that consumers want them, and that, you know, there's nothing artificial about that approach, that really consumers are looking for products that are more sustainable, that protect the planet, that are healthier for themselves, that help other people. You know, a lot of the arguments made around, for example, food miles are actually, I think, quite valid. But you know, the issue of food miles is not specific to organics. I mean, that's the way the industry. The food industry has been built here in the United States. I mean, we like our tomatoes year-round, right? And that means we can source locally during one time of the year, and then they have to come from somewhere else if we want to eat tomatoes the rest of the year. So, you know, I mean, it has to do... Actually, this is related to... The food mile issue is related to the sustainable consumption question. And really, you know, how sustainable are many of the habits that we've developed here in the United States? And is it healthy for the rest of the world to aspire to that model of consumption? I don't know. This is probably a longer conversation, so you know. But we've had to address a lot of the skeptics who attack sustainability from kind of an economic argument, saying you know that these are really artificial approaches. And I think the bottom line is that we're seeing now an overwhelming body of data which suggests that companies and consumers are finding sustainability to be not only a good thing for the planet, but a good thing for business. And that, at the end of the day, makes it not artificial. It makes it eminently sustainable.
Right. And The Economist also said a couple of years ago that corporate responsibility is best approached as a cosmetic exercise than as a serious surgery, which doesn't need fixing. And I always loved that quote from Clive Crook, because I've found that when corporate responsibility is approached as a cosmetic exercise, then companies shouldn't invest at all, because then it's not corporate responsibility, is it? It's just marketing.
All right. I work at As You Sow, which uses shareholder advocacy as a way to motivate corporations to implement CSR approaches. And one thing I'm looking at in particular, well, one is just being able to vote as a shareholder for the companies and use your dollars that way to encourage this. But for Walmart, I'm not interested in organic clothes made in sweatshops or CFL light bulbs. So how do you make sure that the people, not just the planet, is being addressed, and how do you raise the wages of workers around the world, but then also sell that with a business case, because otherwise you just see that the price is going to go up.
By fair trade.
I think fair trade is a part of it, and you know, we need it to grow to be that. I think that what's, you know, I made all these statements about how big Walmart is. Where Walmart feels very small internally is compared to the labor market. So they'll say that, you know, in a market where they have a direct competitor, they'll pay similar wages, and that, you know, when they open up a store in Elgin, in Illinois, they'll have 25,000 people show up for 125 jobs, and those 25,000 people aren't saying I want to be in a sweatshop. They're saying I want a job. Now, we can very quickly ask why that is, and they are and suggest that Walmart might be complicit in the process that's driven down wages in America for a long time. I think that one of the things I was most proud of Walmart was getting behind raising the minimum wage, and it was sort of interesting that when they calculated, I was, you know, it sort of made sense, and I said that's a good social position to take, and someone sort of murmured to me and said it's not public, but we actually it makes sense for us, because we don't pay anyone minimum wage, but a lot of our customers make minimum wage or are affected by it. So it actually helps us to have higher wages. That's good. You know, I think that they should encourage the minimum wage to go up again. I think there are lots of strategies that it should be doing. And this is where CSR should be focused. So I appreciate the question.
So this is the last question, but.
I want to come back to your question, Adam, on that the market demands growth. Does that necessarily mean that in order for companies to grow, in order for our economy to grow, that we all need to be bigger consumers? I teach high school kids who are probably the biggest consumers in the country, and I'm trying to get them or inspire them to consume less. Should consuming less become a tenet of social capitalism?
I think so. I think, I mean, and I love the compact fluorescent light bulb is a great story. It's really interesting because you sell one compact fluorescent in 5 years and you're actually cannibalizing sales of 20, 25 incandescent light bulbs during that time. So you're actually having fewer sales, you're saving a lot of energy, and you're saving people a lot of money. There's a great campaign called 18seconds.org, which is a lot of retailers coming together with Yahoo to get, you know, basically to hit this goal of getting people to switch to that. I think we need successes in products that will help understand that. I think that the trend towards compaction in consumer products, or actually smaller Tide, is actually a good success story because it's less, and saying that less is more, you'll save money, you'll save water, and it's good, even though it has oxy brighteners and there's problems. So I'm looking for behavioral trends that move us towards less and to celebrate the small and to understand, as Schumacher did, that small is beautiful.
So let's give a big hand for our panelists. There's so much to cover, and we just scratched the surface, but it really is an honor to stand here with four people who are on the forefront of this social capitalism movement, and also with an audience that takes these issues so seriously. While we haven't outlined all the solutions or identified all the problems, the commitment is very clear, and I'm very encouraged to be in the room with that. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum is adjourned.